Hello, and welcome to the Craft Brewed Music Podcast, music interviews for serious listeners. You may have heard of our curated music discovery app. The podcast lets us dig deeper and get to know the creators of that music, as well as others that will broaden your horizons. I'm Brian Horner, founder and curator of Craft Brewed Music, and I'm joined by my friend and co-host, Aaron Stamen, a Craft Brewed Music artist. Is Scott Metzger. Village Voice called him an ace guitarist of a thousand styles, and Relic said Metzger's unique style is truly remarkable. His philosophy, as stated on his website, is time, tone, taste, touch. He's played everywhere with everyone and as a member of Joe Russo's Almost Dead. He's got a brand new album, Too Close to Reason, that we're going to get into, and really excited to have you. Thanks a lot, Scott.
Thanks so much for having me. Great to be here.
So you're a band guy, it seems to me, and not just a band guy, but in the context of jam bands, where you know you've got the band, but then there's these rotating casts, you know, more and more people always around. And your new album, however, is a solo effort. Obviously, you know, COVID era inspiration, I'm sure. But I was curious about how that process was, if it was immediately apparent to you that you could do a solo project, or if that took some adjustment to your thinking being from that band world.
Right. Well, I've always, for the last 15 or 20 years, I've been very lucky that I've been very busy playing in other people's bands or playing in different projects with other players. But it's always sort of been on my radar in the back of my mind that someday I would make a record just under my own name. But because I've been so busy for so long, I never really had the time to, or the focus to really come up with the concept of what that would sound like. What would a Scott Metzger album be? Because I've always been so busy learning somebody else's tunes or something, or traveling so much, because I wanted to give that, the solo record, the time and the focus that it would deserve. And like you said, it was definitely, in March of 2020, I was heading into what was going to be the busiest year of my, career. And then everything stopped very, very abruptly. Right. So there were a few weeks there where I was really into the idea of having a long break. I was like, oh, this is great. I won't do anything. And I'll rest up for the first time in a decade.
And what did long mean to you? Were you thinking, 6 weeks?
I was like everybody else, I was at home, and watching the news and being like, okay, a couple of weeks.
We'll close the schools for a couple of weeks and let this thing blow on through.
That's the worst that could happen.
It's a blip.
Right, exactly. And then when it became clear that this was not going to be just a couple of weeks, that's when sort of like, I don't know if panic set in, but it just got very, very real. Yeah. And what I decided was, if I'm going to be stuck at home, open-ended, I was going to buy myself a really nice vintage acoustic guitar, which was always a dream of mine to have, which I hadn't acted on at that point. And I figured if I'm going to be on the sofa for months on end, I might as well, have a good living room guitar.
Yeah.
So I found one down at Carter Vintage in Nashville. Had one online that it was a Martin 00018 from 1955, and I ordered it sight unseen. They were very helpful, and I kind of just panic purchased this thing. And when it got up here, I couldn't put it down. And just a lot of melodies started, you know, I was just constantly playing this thing. And, I think essentially I was just kind of, it was a musical therapy of sorts. Like, I just started writing songs to kind of cheer myself up and to keep some creative skin in the game, so to speak. And,
wow. And so that was literally by late spring or summer, you had moved on to that productive of a phase.
Yeah, it was pretty quick. Like, once I realized that I was here for the long haul, I decided pretty quickly, like, I want to do something to stay creative and stay on the instrument.
Were all the tracks written on that guitar?
Yes. Everything came to me on that instrument. So it really, I mean, you know, if I didn't have that guitar, I don't know if we'd be talking right now about this record.
So going back to something you just said, you had, you know, thought of this project for years, but weren't sure what a Scott Metzger album would look like. So the guitar informed that. And do you think it's the same answer that had been kind of percolating under the surface for years?
Yeah, I think so. It goes all the way back to when I was like in high school, first learning how to play guitar. I've always been a huge Jim Hall fan, who's a jazz guitarist, you know, and one of the most important jazz guitarists that has ever lived. And he had a record that he put out in the 90s when I was in high school. And it was just him, but it was him overdubbing on top of himself. So there would be like three or four tracks of Jim Hall, you know, and it sounded like it was three different guitar players, but it was all just him. And that's essentially what I ended up modeling Too Close to Reason after.
That's interesting. When I was listening to it, there are certainly times where it sounds like it's a guitar duet with you doing a, you know, one guitar is kind of playing the rhythm role and the other one is playing the melodic and improvisational role. But there are times where these two parts kind of congeal in a way that seems very structured and composed. And I'm wondering what the process was of making the separate parts, because it doesn't sound like it was completely spontaneous at all times.
Right. I mean, I think that what I was going for was to make it sound like it was too... The parts were interacting, you know, with one another as if they were being played at the same time. You know, messing with the tempo here and there, pulling the time back, pushing the time forward here and there.
And that effect is certainly achieved. We're wondering, is it how much of that was improvisational? You reacting to what you did on the first track, or were you composing those really cool dissonant harmonies and chords that move together and kind of composing it as a duo or trio piece?
Right. I think it would be like, I don't know, 70-30, the 30% being the improvised part. I tried to leave enough in there that there were spontaneous moments where if I made, like, let's say, you know, in quotes, a mistake or something on one track, I've tried to leave that in as much as possible so that the other part could react to that reactionary way, I guess.
Yeah. Cool.
And on all these tracks, there's usually a third track that's sort of just an atmospheric thing. What I really was going for was the idea of overtones sort of ringing out and a atmospheric kind of thing. Like, I always think of a piano where the sustain pedal doesn't quite work. So that there's, you know, you hear the notes that are being played, but there's also overtones that are kind of connecting the whole thing together. There's a lot of that happening on the record that's maybe only you can hear if you're wearing headphones, but if you took it away, I think it would be very noticeable that something's missing.
Yeah, absolutely. Now, this, you know, we talked about band versus solo, and another thing, well, and of course, electric guitar versus acoustic guitar. Another thing that's really different is that this is so squarely kind of in the, you know, if you have to put a label on it, and it's cool that that's not easy, but if you had to, you know, folk genre, was there any thought to, like, that the people that knew that were fans of your bands and there had been fans of you for years, was there any kind of thought around, you know, how they're going to react to this? Or, you know, there's kind of this different kind, very different kind of swagger, you know, than the electric usually packs. Was there any thought around that and how they might react
No. I mean, if anything, I think that I'm a pretty, I can be sort of a selfish musician in a way where I sort of compartmentalize things. So if J-Rad is known for doing like one sort of thing, I feel like, okay, that base is covered for me personally with that. Mm-hmm. But I want to go somewhere else with other projects, you know, as opposed to being some, like you said, like thinking like, oh, well,
I'm this guy, I've got to do X thing.
Yeah. I mean, you know, I think it's like a 12 or 13 song record in 43 minutes. And J-Rad plays, you know, 90 minute four song sets, you know,
right.
It's a whole different thing.
Yeah.
And so the guitar opened up part of that space. Was there another psychological space that was informing at the same time?
Yeah. I think that a lot of these tunes sound much more hopeful and much more positive. I think that in the past, stuff that I've put out, there's sort of been a grittiness to a lot of stuff that might've been a common thread. Mm-hmm. And I definitely, when I listen back to this record, I noticed that is, noticeably absent. And I think it's a product of the conditions that this stuff was written under, you know, because essentially, like I said, I mean, I was just trying to kind of cheer myself up in what were really tough times.
Yeah.
You know, so I think that this sounds a lot more hopeful and less aggressive than past stuff.
I was going to make a joke that for you, you needed a worldwide pandemic to produce something hopeful and optimistic, but that's just an interesting inversion of what it could have been, you know, I guess.
True. Yeah.
Right. Yeah, absolutely.
The fact that you were able to create this layered sound with you virtually playing every note on the album and reacting to your own playing, that also seems like a challenge for somebody who spends so much time reacting to other musicians and kind of, you know, borrowing their energy and having this interplay with other individuals. Was that a challenge as part of the recording to be kind of looking in the mirror so much during the process?
Yeah, it was a crisis on the first day of the recording. Right? 'Cause I got in there. So I demoed everything like on an iPad, and it was pretty loose. You know, it was just like really sketches of the ideas. And then I booked a couple of days at a studio here in Brooklyn, Restoration Sound. And I literally got in there and I remember, like, you know, I've written some little charts for myself and stuff. And I remember sitting there before we hit record, looking at the charts and being like, how the fuck are we going to do this? Like, I don't know how we're going to, I didn't know where to start, you know, cause it's a really specific, I kind of made this as difficult on myself as possible, honestly, like as a first solo record, like to go in with no producer, no real background in recording in this style of solo guitar and just starting from scratch and trying to come up with a process in real time as to how to make it sound believable.
That's amazing because it sounds so believable and so kind of confident. And so it's really interesting to hear you say that when you sat down in the studio to do it, it was felt like a blank slate, you know?
Yeah, no, I mean, I'm never going to do it again. I don't think because it really was really difficult, you know, and I'm somebody with a lot of experience and I've been in a lot of different scenarios, you know, like musically, I'm all over the place. I can play with a lot of different styles and different, you know, contexts, but I'm glad I did it. I'm proud of how I did it. And I don't think I'll do it again.
It's pretty naked. I mean, you play every note of the album and you can hear every note on the album. That's a lot of sonic responsibility.
Yeah. Well, there's nowhere to really to hide, right? I mean, when you're playing an acoustic guitar, you know, it's kind of like a stock car or something. Like everybody's on a level playing field and you can either do it or you can't.
Mm-hmm.
I always think of, there's a great Keith Richards quote where they're asking him about how, if you want to become a great guitar player, like, what do you have to do? And it's like he already knew the answer. Like, he didn't hesitate at all. He said, you have to be able to make an acoustic guitar sound good. He's like, all the electric stuff, you know, distortion, reverb, effects, all this stuff, that's all gravy on top of what needs to be a really, really solid foundation. So you have to be able to just make an acoustic guitar, the most basic version of the instrument, sound great to be a great guitarist, which I completely agree with. Yeah.
So from a storytelling standpoint, obviously this is instrumental music, but the titles are very evocative, you know, from the couple experimental tracks like Appropriate Wattage and Damage to Asking for a Friend, Waltz for Beverly, When Katie Smiles, which I assume is about your fiance, Katie Jacoby. What were those, you know, how was that process of realizing, did you know what the songs were about? Did you realize it later?
Right. Well, the big joke around the house was when Katie Smiles was written for Katy Perry.
My mistake.
It drives my Katie crazy.
I
was like, we were just on the road and I was making that joke every night and I could feel her rolling her eyes. you know, I mean, with instrumental music, sometimes I think it comes in all different ways. Sometimes the titles come first and dictate what the piece sounds like, and then the vice versa is true as well. A good story about one of the titles, Appropriate Wattage, was that came from a conversation I had with Nels Klein, the guitar player from Wilco, guitar genius, right? Sensei from Wilco.
Yeah.
He and I were doing a gig together with John Medeski and Billy Martin here in town, and we were just going to do an all improvised gig, which, you know, the four of us had never played together before, and Nels called me and we were just talking about the gig and, you know, just, you know, just shooting the shit, and he said, okay, before I get off the phone, like, what kind of amp are you bringing, because I want to make sure that I bring the appropriate wattage for the gig. And so that track is definitely the most, to me, it's the most like experimental sounding track on the record, which is certainly a nod to what Nels Klein means to me. And then other things, you know, Don't Be a Stranger. That's just something that I've been saying to people for years at the end of a conversation. You know, oh, next time you're in town, you know, don't hesitate to reach out. Don't be a stranger. And I was telling someone the other day that I can't really say that anymore because now it sounds like that I'm like advertising my song every time that I say it. Don't be a stranger. And don't forget to download the new EP.
Yeah, Don't Be a Stranger.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. I have to tell this Nels Klein story. I have a friend who's a huge Wilco fan here in Seattle.
Yeah.
And he was so excited. He's like, oh my God, I got his tickets to go see the Wilco guitar player. It's going to be great. I love Wilco so much. And it was not at all what he expected. It was Nils Klein and Julian Lage playing their duet stuff, which is really, really esoteric out there stuff.
Yeah.
And it was this small little venue called the Royal Room in Seattle. And the whole time I'm like, this is awesome. And I looked at my friend. He's like, what the fuck is this?
Yeah. No, well, Nels's thing is not for everybody. I mean, he was like a punk rock guy for years and years. Like it's actually way beyond punk rock. It's like almost just like noise experimental stuff. And that's his roots. And that's what he does. To his credit, I think that takes a lot of guts to have a fan base, like a Wilco fan base, where he gets, you know, that's definitely where he became like a household name. Right.
Yeah.
But when he goes out and does his own thing, he does not worry about like, oh, is this going to, you know, are the Wilco people going to dig this? Like he's still doing him, which to somebody like me is like incredibly inspiring. And like, I really think it's like, you know, to have the guts to do that shows a lot of integrity. Like not everybody does that.
Yeah. You know?
Yeah, absolutely. And it cuts both ways too, because then when I, you know, when I go and see Wilco and I see him doing something weird in the middle of a solo, like everything feels very authentic, that he's probably doing whatever he wants to do at that moment.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, I've played with him, you know, because he was in New York up until the pandemic. They left town like like about 90% of the musicians that I know, they got out of town during the pandemic. But we did a lot. We've done a lot of playing together over the years, and I definitely look up to him as like a mentor and just somebody that I'm incredibly lucky to make music with. Thing is like, you know, when you get up that close to somebody who has that unique of a voice, I've had these experiences. I'm very lucky. I've had these experiences, like to be on stage with somebody like Nels or somebody like Scofield. It's like, you know, you really see why they are who they are. Because they have such a unique thing. It's like, man, there's nothing textbook about what these guys are doing. Like they've invented sort of a whole new instrument almost.
Yeah. Well, speaking of defying convention and not pandering to the expectations of your audience, tell me about Damage, which is a very experimental sounding disjointed tune that does not have the hopeful tone.
It doesn't.
The other songs.
Yeah, no, and honestly, I sort of thought about it. I kept going back and forth as to like whether or not to have that on the record because it does stand out so much. And I said, you know what? This is the one tune that does have that grit that sort of represents all the previous stuff. It's got that grit and then some. Mm-hmm. and I was like, I gotta be real here, you know, that is part of who I am. And it's not all just when Katie smiles, you know, there's real stuff going on here. And it's funny, that was definitely influenced. I'm a big fan of that Nels and Julian duo. And that was definitely influenced by that.
Yeah. And was it also, so it was written in that early pandemic period, was it? Cause now that you mention, you know, kind of the grit, it pretty nicely encapsulates that, ominous, you know, the quality of the unknown, you know, that period felt like a lot of us. Was that in there as well?
Sure. Yeah. Well, I mean, you know, you, if you weren't in New York City in March and April, 2020, you can't imagine what it was like down here. Yeah. It was, I mean, not to be too dark, but like, you know, just, and because we're right in the city and there's hospitals in either direction about, you know, 10 blocks in either direction. And there were just ambulance sirens like 24/7. You couldn't go to any supermarkets. Like you just, it was like living in a war zone, you know? And, that was, you know, that was in there. Yeah. The grit and the uncertainty and the tension, all those things were very, very real, you know, on top of all my entire household losing all of its work.
Of course.
There was that whole element too.
Yep.
Because my wife is a musician as well. So
Now, the last track on the album, At Your Service, I believe is the only one with electric guitar on it. Is that correct?
No, that's all acoustic.
Really?
Yeah.
What am I hearing there?
It's an electric guitar. So the guy who mixed it, Dan Goodwin, he put a lot of reverb and delays on those guitars, but it's really just some arpeggios. You know, it's arpeggios with a low bass line that he might have put a doubler on, so there might be like a lower octave that kind of maybe that's what gives it that electric fuller sound. But honestly, that tune came about just because the label was like, the album's not long enough. You know, you need another 5 minutes. And I basically just made it up on the spot.
Really?
Oh. We dug that tune. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, to me, I would love to see that in a movie. I mean, I think a lot of this stuff lends itself very well to a visual aspect. But that one in particular, I could certainly see being in a movie or something. So if anybody's listening,
is appropriate wattage. That was all an acoustic guitar that had been treated.
Yeah. So that's acoustic guitar, and it's played with a little gadget called an Ebo.
Oh.
Which I don't want to speak out of turn, but I've never heard of anybody using an Ebo on an acoustic guitar before. And when I tried it, I don't remember what made me think to try it, but when I tried it, I was like, oh, it's such a beautiful sound. It sounds like, such a pure tone, like if you rub your finger around the edges of a wine glass.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You know, it's like that pure sound. Yeah, that's what that is. Again, with an octave thing below it to the Dan. That was all Dan's idea.
And so what was the drone sound in Dream Room Part One?
It's like the greatest instrument ever invented. It's called a Regini box. It's the best thing I've ever found to practice to, because it's like this cool little box. I think that they made them like in the 80s, and maybe they still make them, but they're not a household thing. Like they're not around, you don't see them all the time. But they have these, you can have sitar drones. It's like a little box that has preloaded sitar drones. And then you can also program in tabla patterns to play on top of the drone. So you can practice, you know, playing, you know, the tabla settings are like, they have different meters, different tempos. Like it's really a cool thing. And there's an app version of it, but that's, you know, that's just not as cool. Right.
Yeah. No.
Right.
you want the box.
Yeah, exactly. It's like everything else. It's like the tuner apps and stuff. I can't do it. I not tune my guitar with an iPhone. I never will do that. You know.
Thank you.
And so as we emerge from this interesting period of time in history, and you get to go back out on the road again, how do you see realizing some of these tunes on the stage that were conceived as duets and trios?
Right. Well, I just got home from a 4-night run of the first time performing this stuff ever. And I brought along a guitar player with me, Simon Kafka. Mm-hmm. He's a great guitarist here in Brooklyn, a dear friend of ours. And he sort of filled out the second guitar role, I guess you'd call it. And it really, I mean, he's hired. Like, it really couldn't have gone any better, actually. And we played to really, really enthusiastic, you know, pin drop quiet audiences. I couldn't ask for a better fan base. You know, it was just like, I wouldn't change a thing, really.
There's a question I'd like to ask. I'm a reader of the New York Times, and they had an editorial this last week entitled "Why We Can't Quit the Guitar Solo." I don't know if you came across that or not.
I did.
You did. And so for our listeners, this is kind of amusing on, you know, seemingly an outdated, overly masculine thing from the 1980s with lots of pyrotechnics and testosterone that, you know, was kind of shunned in the 90s, but it still persists in popular music. And I'm very curious, in this day and age, as a hardworking guitar player, what is the current state of the guitar solo?
Oh my God. Yeah. I mean, you know, I think that the guitar solo, you know, now the idea of it, I don't know, you know, it's such a tough question because it's like you said, like the testosterone element to me is super played out mm-hmm. when it comes to the guitar solo. Like that yeah. to me does not interest me too much. I mean, except for just like novelty, you know, I'll go back and put on old Skid Row records or, you
know, right.
I grew up in Jersey, you know, like I had a mullet. But you know, to me, it's much more about like intelligence and like you know, saying something and doing something unexpected within the framework of a solo, as opposed to where you say like, oh man, like that's really a thoughtful thing that just happened. Yeah. As well as giving you a dose of the testosterone, but like being like, oh man, like that was great, as opposed to just the like fist pumping, tapping yeah. like thing, you know. I don't know.
Yeah.
I don't know. What do you guys think? I mean, maybe I'm wrong in thinking that, because I see a lot of stuff, especially in the jam band scene, where it's like it's just like fucking full throttle, like shredding from the jump, and people love it, you know. So what, yeah, I don't know.
Well, there's like a primal or visceral thing to that, but yeah, I mean, I think we're very much on the side that you're describing. We were talking about that actually earlier today with regard to your playing, actually in all formats, this album, but also, you know, other work you've done, that you're obviously technically capable of doing whatever you want on the guitar, but your playing is, you know, melodically driven, music driven, song driven, as opposed to just, you know, technique driven. Look what I can do. You know?
Yeah, for sure. I mean, you know, I think that the ultimate is to be able to compose a new song during a guitar solo. So then mm-hmm. like, you know, but there's plenty of testosterone guys that can do that too. Like to me, you know, Appetite for Destruction, those are like brilliant guitar solos. You know, every solo on that record is super brilliant, but it's not particularly, you know, like thoughtful or doesn't sound very sensitive at all, right? Like, basically, what? We're just doing a podcast about Nels Klein. But when you go back and listen to, well, no, but to me, in the last 15 years, to me, the guitar solo is Impossible Germany. I feel like that guitar solo has everything about the modern guitar solo that's
I agree. I completely agree.
That you could possibly want. And it, because he starts with this like really like knock you to your knees, like sensitive, vulnerable melody, but then ends up with this like super atonal, almost just freak out noise. Yeah. So it's like, it's got all the bases covered. And that's why that solo, you know, when you go to see Wilco, everybody's like waiting with bated breath when Impossible Germany starts for the solo to get there.
Mm-hmm.
Cause he nailed it. It's like, it's everything that you, what more could you want from a guitar?
Yeah. Yeah, no, it tells a story every time.
Yeah. Right. Right.
Yeah. I find for my sensibilities, and part of it's getting, I mean, cause I obviously was, you know, raised on Guns N' Roses and all the shredding guitar players and Malmsteen and Satriani. Like I part of me still yearns for the blast of testosterone you get with those solos. But these days I don't want to, come to the guitar solo part of a recording or a part of a live performance and be like, oh, how is he doing that? I want to be saying to myself, that's an interesting choice.
Yes. Right.
So is that partly an age thing? We're all, you know, give or take the same age. Mm-hmm. Or like, did you feel like that as a teenager, Scott, or were you in a totally different headspace?
No, I was totally different. Like I just wanted more notes higher up on the neck, just all of it, you know? But as I've gotten older, you know, you realize there's sort of like this lineage of guys that were onto something different, you know, even though they were surrounded by the testosterone. Like today, this morning, I was listening to Television, Marquee Moon.
Hmm.
To me, that's like, you know, exactly what we're talking about. Like those guys, every solo, you're like, huh, like I wouldn't have thought of that. You know, he didn't just go for the lowest hanging fruit and.
Was Mark Ribot ever a part of your listening experience?
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely.
Okay. That was the, when I was first listening to the Wolf records, I was like, oh man, like I've been trying to find something that gives me that same juice as the Mark Ribot band. And like I feel like that's the closest.
Oh, man.
I've come to that. Really, that's really huge. Great sound.
That's a huge compliment as far as I'm concerned.
But a guy who's not super technical in his playing, but like the choices he makes just are always unexpected and always confident.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. And he's a guy that I've read an interview with him too, where he said, you know, he's like, we live in a culture where somehow people think that the higher up on the neck you play, it's more impressive,
mm-hmm.
as opposed to being able to play like a really great melody with great dynamics and, you know.
Well, I think we see parallels to that in all corners of our culture and society, you know, sound bites, tweets, instead of statements and thoughtful analysis.
Yeah, man. I mean, we, you know, for better or for worse, you know, shtick very often trumps substance.
Yeah, right.
In everything in this country, right?
Right. So when you're trying to when you've put the bar there for yourself and you're trying to be sensitive and be surprising, presumably every time, how or do you sometimes find that well is dry, or how do you how do you make sure you get there every time that you need to?
Yeah, I think it's something that you really can't. I find that as soon as I start trying to do pretty much anything musically, but trying to do something like that immediately, like you lose it. It's more of just like a feeling that I'm familiar with. And I just try to stay in that lane as much as possible. And when I feel myself getting out of that lane, kind of take a breath and recenter myself to, you know, and just not go for the obvious stuff, you know, because there's a lot of stuff that it's like just seems so obvious. I don't know. Mm-hmm. You know, we live a day and age where it's like, the electric guitar is not a new thing anymore. So there's so many just sort of like go-to moves that everybody thinks of immediately or has under their fingers. And I feel like it's our job to, or it's my job to stay away from that as much as possible, except for very key moments where you really just give them that, you know, the fist pump thing. Because we all deserve that every once in a while, you know? Come on.
I'm eager to give Scott a chance to tell us what's up next, how to find the album, how to find you live, what's going on.
Yeah, well, you know, there's scottmetzger.com, which is probably more information than anybody needs about me. yeah, everything's there, and you can get the record at Royal Potato Family Records. It's easy enough to find, and we've got shows coming up. I know there's a couple coming up, one in New Hampshire and one in Vermont in early May, in addition to, you know, ton of different projects. J-Rad, I'm playing with John Medeski and Mono Neon here in the city later this month. Yeah, staying busy. Happy, very grateful to be busy again.
Yeah, for sure. And the new record is on vinyl, I saw at Royal Potato Family's site.
Yep.
We've really enjoyed diving into it and talking with you. We appreciate the time.
Yeah, likewise, guys. This was a great conversation. Thanks for having me.
Thanks a lot, Scott.
Take care.
Thank you for listening. Craft Brewed Music, both the podcast and the Music Discovery app, has the mission of promoting this music and these artists. We can't do that without ears on the music. So if you like what you've heard here, we're going to ask you two small favors. First, tell someone about the podcast. Second, go to the App Store or Google Play, download the Craft Brewed Music app, and try a free 2-week trial of the curated streaming service. For more information, visit us at craftbrewedmusic.com. Thanks again, and see you next time.